April 10th, 2013. We have lots of work sessions today, but a lot of the fiscals and so on are not in on those. And so after we have the first public hearing, I'll go over those in case you, I know you want to stay for the entire meeting, but just in case you're there just for those issues, we can let you know. Do we want to know which things are going to carry over? Excuse me just a moment. Okay.
I think that certainly you're carrying this one over.
Okay.
And this one.
Okay, so just for information, for certain we are carrying over House Bill 2214. Oh, no, we may not be hearing 2214. We're going to be carrying over 2908 because we don't have the fiscal in on that one. And we're going to be carrying over. This one we're going to carry over, sure. We're going to carry over 2672 domestic workers. Okay. Okay, with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill. I'm going to start with this one.
Mm-hmm.
House Bill 2410. Jan, if you could summarize, please.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. This measure requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to request a waiver from the federal government of the federal requirements for the operation of small cranes that are mounted on boom trucks. You have a -4 amendment that replaces the measure, and it requires DCBS to adopt rules authorizing a person to operate a boom truck with the lifting capacity under 21 tons if the person's completed an apprenticeship program or a third-party training, training through a third-party organization.
Thank you. We do have Michael Woods from DCBS. Do the other gentlemen want to come up or just have Mr. Woods take care of it?
Chair Doherty, committee members, for the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we generally refer to simply as Oregon OSHA. I've been asked to provide just a little bit of context for the discussion around House Bill 2410. In February of 2011, Oregon OSHA adopted rules that followed the federal comprehensive construction crane standard. And those rules contained a number of provisions. The specific provision at issue here takes effect in November of 2014, and that relates to crane operator training and certification of those operators and the requirements related to that training. In the fall of the same year, some folks, including individuals from the NECA and other organizations, came to us and said that there were some problems that they were anticipating related to the training requirements as they involved boom-mounted, relatively small capacity cranes. We indicated at the time that we believed that we could probably develop a rulemaking proposal that would address those concerns, would not only provide some greater flexibility, but actually we think we're still hopeful we can craft a rule that would provide greater worker protection. And ultimately, obviously, our rule would need to pass muster with federal OSHA and be approved as meeting the at least as effective as requirement that is found in both state and federal laws. We developed that proposal and we took a proposal to hearing earlier this year. And as we went through the comments on the proposal, we decided that we really didn't have a workable proposal. And for that reason, we withdrew the rule that we had proposed and declared that we would be re-empaneling the stakeholder group and a somewhat broader stakeholder group than we had worked with in developing the first proposal. And those meetings will begin next month. It is still our belief that we can develop a rule that will address these issues and that will pass federal muster. Now, I'll say belief. Mm-hmm. I don't offer that with any certainty. And we do intend to actively pursue that rulemaking in an effort to resolve these issues well ahead of the November 2014 deadline created by the effective date of the provision. I guess that really sort of provides the broader context in terms of the administrative rulemaking we're proposing, and unless there there any questions, I think I'm finished.
Okay, are there any questions for Mr. Wood? I just have one clarification. Oh, go ahead, Mr. Holby.
Thanks. I'm just looking at the Dash 4 amendments, and you're speaking about training. And if I'm reading this right, you're not supporting this bill at this time? You're going back for more rulemaking?
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, it has always been the department's position that we could address this through our existing rulemaking authority, and we have been actively pursuing that. The bill is not our bill. We don't actually have a position on the bill as originally before you.
Maybe just have a clarification. The groups have been meeting this morning and are going through and have come to some sort of an agreement as to what they can do through the rulemaking process. So if you want to...
I'll ask my questions offline then, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, okay, as I say, it's one of these things that with this bill, the interested parties have gotten together and talked about some of the rulemaking issues. And so hopefully we'll be able to get this resolved through the rulemaking process and all the stakeholders coming together and coming to an agreement. Any other questions of Mr. Wood? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, anyone else like to speak on House Bill 2410? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2410 and open up a hearing on House Bill 3180. Find it through all the files here.
Yes. Madam Chair and committee members, this bill authorizes an off-premise licensee to store wine, cider, and malt beverages at a licensed premise for the transport to another off-premise licensee. And you have before you Dash 2 amendment that replaces the measure, and I do believe that Mr. Goldie is going to walk the committee through that amendment.
Thank you. Representative Holvey, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for spending a lot of time down in this seat this session. For the record, Paul Holvey, House District 8, State Representative. I have House Bill 3180, and I will note that it was a pretty broad bill as drafted and really didn't quite address what we were aiming for. And so we have the Dash 2 amendment that that replaces the bill. And the purpose of the Dash 2 amendment is essentially to streamline some of the licensing and the sideboards that are put on breweries, brew pubs, and wineries and the such. I've visited and talked with many of the brew pub and brewery folks, and they often have confusion about what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. Some breweries and brew pubs have different restrictions in terms of transporting their product, of distributing their product, of selling their product to the public, and also what kind of food they can serve and what kind of licenses they need. And so this bill is meant to sort of align some of these processes so that our growing brewery industry especially can kind of create their own business model of how they're going to operate. And that's part of what this bill does. It essentially allows breweries to do things that brew pubs can do and allows brew pubs to do things that breweries can do. Because currently they have different restrictions on a wide range of things. And there's also a piece in the bill that does allow a brewery license who has another license for an off-premises site to be able to transport their product between their licensed facilities, which currently stands in the way. And there's a lot of little elements of this of our current OLCC statutes regulating breweries and brew pubs that basically prevent many of these operations from really developing their business model to expand or to cater to a specific business goal because of the restrictive nature of our OLCC regulations on brew pubs and brewery licenses and the differences between those. So this bill is trying to align those activities that they both should, in my mind, should be able to do to move their particular business model forward. It seems like I've asked OLCC, well, why do these restrictions, why is this restriction here for them and not for them? How come we have these differences? And evidently it goes back to prohibition when we had, clandestine operators controlling the alcohol industry. And so there's a lot of history built into our laws and rules, and I'm just here to say, we've moved beyond prohibition, and we should be looking at helping this industry grow and not maintaining these over-restrictive restrictions on how they sell their product, how they make a business model, and attract members of the public to help their industry grow and provide the great products that they have to the general public without ridiculous restrictions. That's the purpose of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Foldy? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, thank you for bringing the bill forward. I entirely agree with you that the fabric of OLCC statutes and regulations is often antiquated and pretty bizarre, but that actually makes me cautious more than it, because I've learned that sometimes if you pull on a thread here, it's more interconnected than I at first thought. And so I'm wondering, with this bill in particular, I understand the kind of general context, is there a specific problem or a specific issue? Do you have a constituent, for example, that's having a problem this bill is trying to solve?
Madam Chair, Representative Barton, I have had questions from several different brew pub owners and brewery owners, and the way their marketplace is structured and the power of distributors, and they're very reluctant to come forward for fear that their product won't get put in a particular place or somebody won't carry it, and they depend on that existing marketplace to make sure their product gets sold to the public. And I just question why, for example, why can a brewery self-distribute and a brew pub cannot self-distribute their product? And, I think if they choose to use a distributor, they should be able to use a distributor. If they choose to self-distribute, regardless of which license they have, they should be able to do that. And so the answer to your question is yes. Will I name them so that power structure can, beat them down a little bit and try to keep them quiet? No, I probably won't go that far.
No problem. Follow up, please.
Please.
So, without naming names, I'm not trying to prompt a backlash from the existing power structure. But what I gather is that it's brew pubs wishing to self-distribute that is the issue we're trying to address here. Is that it? And sir,
Madam Chair, Representative Barton. No.
Okay.
That may be part of it, for some, but not for all.
Okay.
Others' issue is just being able to transport their own product between their licensed facilities.
Gotcha.
Other of them may want to, for example, breweries are restricted on their dock sales of what they can sell to the public. They can't sell growlers, for example, but brew pubs can. So can wineries, but breweries can't. They have a limit. I tried to reduce what they were able to sell. It used to be 5 gallons. Now it's 4 gallons. They can't sell anything less than 4 gallons at dock sales. And so why do they have that restriction on them when brew pubs do not?
Mm-hmm.
Because they may want to self-distribute, so they have a brewery license, but yet they can't expand their business model to sell growlers or a smaller volume, to the public at dock sales. Okay. So I asked the question, and I've worked with OLCC pretty extensively on drafting the Dash 2, and there's some language fixes in there that they would like wanted to put into this bill to help it make sense for them, to streamline their licensing and enforcement. I think it would be helpful to them as well. Obviously, they probably are not supporting or opposing this bill, but certainly can answer some technical questions mm-hmm. about the bill if you wish. I don't know if they're here or not, but
thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, the only other person we have signed up is Paul Romaine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and we are in opposition to 3180 with the amendments, actually even without the amendments. First of all, you're going to have to indulge me a little bit. I'm going to have to give you a little bit of history and correct a couple of things that have been out there. First of all, brew pubs can self-distribute. Brew pubs can self-distribute as long as their production is under 5,000 barrels, which is 10,000 kegs. They can self-distribute, and quite a few of them take advantage of that. Breweries can self-distribute because they're a brewery. We have in Oregon what's called a two-tier system, as opposed to most states, which have a three-tier system. Three-tier system basically came out of Prohibition. You basically had the different parts of alcohol getting the consumer separated from each other. Manufacturers couldn't own an interest in a wholesaler. Wholesalers couldn't own an interest in a retailer, and back through the chain. In Oregon, we always had what was called a two-tier system because we allowed manufacturers and wholesalers, we allowed breweries to do their own self-distribution because we had Blitz Weinhard, we had a lot of other breweries in the state. So we always had a two-tier system. But nobody in the wholesale or brewing end of it could own an interest or have any interest in a retail establishment. It was to break the chain, basically, because that's one of the problems that was in a pre-prohibition. It was the manufacturer controlling the product from cradle to grave. So fast forward to the 80s. Beer is out there, and there's a lot of people that are starting to think that maybe it'd be really good for my restaurant if I could brew. So they set up, what we did was we set up a brew pub license. And the brew pub license basically said, all right, assuming that you can only operate in two tiers, you have to make a choice. Do you want to be a retailer and have a restaurant and brew? That's the brew pub. You can't wholesale at that point. Or do you want to be a brewery and wholesale, but you can't have a restaurant at that point? And subsequent, that was the basic change that was made in the 80s. What it's done, if you look at the industry, we were light years ahead of every other state. And what it's done is it's fostered an industry that has been remarkable, absolutely remarkable. From what I understand, about 17% of beer that's sold in the state is Oregon-produced micro. That's an astronomical figure when you look at any other state. If you're up in the city of Portland, at least, I'd say, over half of the beer that's poured in the city of Portland is Oregon-produced in kegs. So the industry has thrived, absolutely thrived. What it also did was to set up a sort of an informal arrangement where we work things out within the industry quite a bit. We talk within the industry. We have meetings with the brewers. We sit down and we try and work out issues. For example, on the brew pub self-distribution, it really was an impediment to getting to market for brew pubs to not be able to self-distribute some of their product. When you get to a certain point, you don't self-distribute. You just don't. The marketplace is crazy, and you are crazy to self-distribute. You put it with a distributor. The brew pubs, actually, there's one distributor out there that basically just does Oregon micros. They're not a member of our group, but they're a distributor nonetheless. But it basically allows you to get into the marketplace, get your beer established, and then once you get up to a certain point, you really don't want to do any more distribution yourself because it's too big of an investment. You'd rather invest in the production portion of it. What I'm saying is this bill is trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. There really is, within the industry, I talked to the Oregon Brewers Guild before I came down here. We can't figure out where this comes from. There's really no push anyplace. There might be little tweaks here and there, and we go over that all the time, and we'll bring you particular issues. For example, there was one brew pub, Pelican, I believe, on the coast that wanted to self-distribute a little more, and so we raised the limit up. And we came in with a joint bill on that. This one was sort of surprise, here's a bill, and there may be little individual things in there that we might want to talk about, but nobody's really had a chance within the industry to kind of work that out. And there's nothing that's pressing right now. So what we would say to you is take a break from this. If there's something that's pressing, and if there is a brewer out there who wants to do something, we work with them all the time. They work with us all the time on many, many issues ranging from taxes to actual structure of the industry. And again, I challenge you, look at the industry. Look at what it's done. I mean, not a lot of tweaking you need to do. Basically, you need to leave it alone and let it run because it's been a very, very successful industry. So I would urge you to let this bill lie and see if it improves with age, like 2015.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Yeah, Mr. Romaine, I just want to thank you for coming up here and letting us know that a friend of mine who started his own little brewery is not illegally dispensing his stuff because I know he is selling it in stores and he's distributing it himself, and it's what you have to do when you're first getting started. So
yes.
I was a little nervous when I was hearing Representative Hulvey's testimony. I didn't want to mention his name and because it's like, oh, shoot, he's doing something illegal, but he's under the 5,000 gallons, I think, so he's fine.
Yeah, it's actually... Madam Chair, Representative Widener, it's 5,000 barrels, and a barrel is 31 gallons. So we're talking a lot of beer that you can basically get into the market. I mean, the whole idea, when we thought about this back in the 80s, it was, I've used this term, I don't know if it's correct or not, we call it yuppifying beer. Wine had done that. Basically made yuppies into beer, into wine drinkers, and the panache and all that. But this was to sort of yuppify beer, and it's worked. It's worked beautifully.
You're saying real men did not drink wine back then? You're not going to say anything, are you?
I'm not going to say anything.
Good
very,
try,
very,
though.
Very smart. Representative Hulvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Romaine. I know we've had some discussions about this, and you know, you do make all these points, but I'm curious. You know, you say, well, a brew pubs can self-distribute if they produce less than 5,000 gallons. Why do, or 5,000 barrels? Why? What's the purpose of having a limit at all?
Madam Chair,
because I mean, if, you know, you say, well, they'd be crazy to do that after a while. So, you know, well, if they're crazy, let's let them make the choice instead of putting it in law and saying you can't do this.
Madam Chair, Representative Hulvey, the reason that we set up a distribution kind of limit, if you would, was to keep the system sort of in place. In other words, you had to make a choice. If you want to be in the retail end, which is have a restaurant, and you can have numerous restaurants, you can be in the business. You can't have a brewery and do that. You can't own a restaurant. You could have another brewery with a restaurant, but you had to make a choice. And in alcohol, that's what it is. A wholesaler, for example, cannot have a restaurant. We can't have restaurants. We're limited to the same restriction on brew pubs selling over the dock. I mean, not brew pubs, but breweries selling over the dock. Wholesalers have that same restriction. We can't, in effect, be in competition with the retail, the actual retail end of it. It's an arbitrary limit? Yes, absolutely. But most of alcohol law is arbitrary. Most of alcohol law is set up because it's not potato chips, and because you want something that's a little bit different for things that possibly, if abused, can cause great harm. I think I said that politically correctly.
Follow up, and I thank you, Mr. Romaine and Madam Chair, for your indulgence, and I won't go on too long. But I think you've pointed out some of the issues that that we're trying to fix. Is you know why have these restrictions where a brewery can't have a restaurant, or why have you know the restriction a brew pub can't self-distribute over 5,000 barrels or whatever? Those limits are limits, and the and that's what we're trying to address, because you're restricting essentially the free market ability of a brewery or a brew pub to make their own business plan and distribute their own product with these arbitrary restrictions.
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, you're absolutely right. There are arbitrary restrictions on alcohol, and that's just because we put arbitrary restrictions on alcohol, and they're not really arbitrary, they're rational, because we have an interest in doing it, a state interest in doing it, but we do put restrictions on it. There's 100 and some brew pubs out there. There's like 13 breweries in the state. I don't think that the industry considers these restrictions or limits to be much of an impediment to their growth, given what's been happening out there. I think the industry is doing very, very well, and again, I get to the remark that Representative Barton said, a lot of this stuff looks a little weird, but sometimes if you pull on one string, you might lose the whole sweater, and that's kind of an issue for us.
Okay. Good questions? I have a question, and I think one of the aspects of this legislation is for brew pubs to be able to store their beer off-premise or at a different site. Is that something that is currently in law, something that needs to be changed? Because I can see some of the, and I'm just thinking of a brew pub in my own, in Tigard, that they're getting more restricted for space to be able to store their beer.
Madam Chair, that I believe that issue has been solved in a bill that will be coming over to you from the Senate. It passed out of the Business Committee. It deals with transportation by a brew pub from one place to another place.
Okay.
So I think that issue is being solved. And again, that was something that was brought to us. Actually, Representative Holby actually brought that up, and then Senator Prozansky also brought it up, and it's a legit issue, and once you run out of storage space, you should be able to move stuff around, and so there is a bill that went through with, I don't think, much testimony, and it should be fine. You should have it, and we hope you pass it out.
That's nice to hear, because I think that they were talking in our little local brew pub that we'd have to sit on the kegs, you know, out in the restaurant part. We didn't want to do that.
Some of those are so hand-to-mouth operations that they may use them as chairs and just kind of...
That's right. That's right. Okay, are there any other questions of Mr. Romaine? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have nobody else signed up. Is there anyone else would like to speak on House Bill 3180? Okay, if not, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3180, and I open up a public hearing on House Bill 3473. Jan, can you give a summary?
Well. Madam Chair.
We have lots of files up here.
This measure prohibits a public body from entering into a public contract of more than $50,000 for public improvement or public works unless the iron, the steel, manufactured goods intended for use in the project are made within the United States. It provides an exception if the amount or the quality of the iron, steel, or goods made within the U.S. are insufficient or would cause the cost to increase more than 25%. There is no amendment before you.
Okay. I think we'll start out with Ilana Guinea and John Molas. You're welcome.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Bill and Trades. Thanks for taking the time to hear this bill this morning. In the past couple sessions, we've tried to get a Buy American policy in place for the state of Oregon, and we had a couple work groups, and it got pretty big and pretty complicated real fast. So this session, we consciously stepped back and decided to simplify it. We asked legislative counsel to draft language that would mirror the federal Buy American Act, and so what's in front of you is legislative counsel's best efforts to do that. It's the same limits. It's the same rules. It's the same off-ramps. It's the exact same rules that are in place when the feds fund a project here in Oregon, either exclusively or if it's a blend of federal and state monies that fund the project. And so all we're asking is to take those same rules to state-funded and locally funded projects. I think you'll hear from opponents that it's unconstitutional and burdensome. We've got a handout that shows other states where there's similar policies in place that have been upheld in court, so we don't believe that's true. We don't believe it's burdensome either because, like I said, it's the exact same policy that's in place now under the federal act, same rules. Agencies are used to it. Contractors are used to it. We think it's good policy. It supports American jobs, supports American manufacturing, and thank you for taking the time to hear it. I'll do my best to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Skinny?
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Guinea. I'm here on behalf of the 250,000 members of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Perennially, we talk about how we should be using our public dollars, and I think John summed up pretty well for you why the bill before you is different from past attempts to pass similar legislation and why it's a bill that has bipartisan support. I understand that you'll hear that this is complicated. As John said, any agency that's using federal dollars is already complying with Buy America standards. Depending on the type of work they do, either these standards or similar standards, there are a few different versions of Buy America in federal statute that I'm sure complicate things much more than anything we could do at the state level. I understand that you'll hear that there could be liability issues. I would ask the opponents of the bill how they deal with liability issues that may come up under federal standards and why it would be any different at the state level. And I understand you'll hear that this might cost more. There are standards in this bill, just like in the federal Buy America statutes, that put a cap on that possibility and ensure that we're both being responsible with our spending of public dollars and with how we spend those public dollars. And I'd ask, as I sit with some of the opponents to this bill trying to figure out how to grow our economy, how to support good jobs in Oregon, industrial jobs in Oregon, how better to do that than to do it with our own dollars? We've got an opportunity as the state of Oregon to decide how we spend our money. And if we're already spending some of that money on projects that have standards like this, why not make sure that we're doing that with our state dollars too and not just our federal dollars? We urge you to consider this much more simple version of Buy America than you've seen in the past. This is very similar to what we already do in specific projects through funding bills for those projects in Oregon. And I hope that you will vote yes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of the panelists? Representative Thatcher?
Do you have any idea how much is being spent on non-American steel in state government, for instance?
You know, I don't, and we've talked in the past. I'm sorry, Chair Doherty, Rep. Thatcher, I don't. We've talked in the past about looking at a study to find that out. I know that there's not always a lot of appetite for studies, though, so we haven't done that. We've got a little bit of information that's come out of the optional bill that was passed. It was either HB 3000 or 3300. I'm bad with repeat numbers. I apologize, a few sessions ago. And we've seen with that there are some local governments and agencies that I think are more willing to say, let's try to do this, and others that aren't. There are some projects where it's easier than others. That ease is definitely why we make sure in any bill to say where we can't find the products, let's not hold things up. We don't want to do that. But we don't have specific numbers, and unless there's the will to do a major study that I think would cost a lot of money for not getting much done, we won't be able to get anything specific.
And just to follow up, too, this relates to more than just state government. You're saying any
Correct.
Public body, so
Correct.
Any local jurisdiction, municipality, whatever.
Chair Doherty, Rep. Thatcher, that is correct. Generally, it's state agencies that are already looking at the federal money coming in, although sometimes that is on local projects also, and for that reason, we tried to mirror it for both levels of government.
And then one more question,
please.
Madam Chair, I think. There are some projects that allow for a certain percentage of foreign steel. Is this allowed at all in this instance?
Chair Doherty, Rep. Thatcher, there's not a provision in there that calls out a specific percentage, but with the sufficient quantity, sufficient quality, and cost overrun standards that are in the bill, I would think that if a contractor were having trouble finding enough American steel, that they would be able to, under this statute, look elsewhere. It isn't specifically called out, though.
Actually, Madam Chair, I have one more question.
Please.
Along with this, would this require extra certifications and, I guess, pedigrees, so to speak, to be able to trace it all the way back to a domestic source? That would cause a lot more enforcement issue and paperwork issue on both ends.
Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher, that is a piece of the bill that we specifically look to the federal standards to copy, so that it wouldn't create any extra burden. So where it is a contractor who has not had projects with federal dollars before, this will be something new, but where we're talking about contractors who are used to dealing with federal dollars, it'll be the same process, the same recording process. They actually will be able to look to the federal standards, where there are lists of products that have been certified as made in America or not, and pull from those lists. At least that's our understanding from Legislative Council.
Okay. Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Did you have another
questions? Not for the moment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative Fagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, really. I'm obviously new to the legislature, but having followed it for at least a couple of sessions, every time that there's a big kind of infrastructure project, it's always deemed as a jobs bill. And every time somebody comes and lobbies me about supporting any type of building or construction, it's always about it being a jobs bill. But it strikes me as odd that while that is the talk, that we don't have something like this already on the books. Because if we're actually, you know, whether it's cool schools about school districts being able to retrofit their buildings, if we're actually going to make the jobs bills more than just talk, I think something like this is very necessary, and I'm very supportive.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to piggyback on Representative Fagan's comment and ask if either of you have any vague notion of what this might be able to do in terms of job creation numbers or potential examples of projects that could have generated more jobs or anything along that line.
Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, again, without a study, I can't really tell you how many jobs this bill might create. Probably the most glaring example that I can think of where the California DOT purposely went around the Buy American Act for steel for the Bay Bridge, and it came in from Korea. And the overwhelming majority of it was either rejected or it had to be shipped on shore and completely refabricated and rebuilt. And it ended up costing the taxpayers a lot more money than if they just would have sourced it originally for steel made in the United States. And it's frustrating to me as well, and I appreciate your comments, and I appreciate Representative Fagan's comments. I think everybody would agree that it's in our best interest in the United States and in Oregon to maintain and grow our manufacturing base. And we went out of our way to make this exactly mirror the federal policy. So when a water district gets federal dollars to help them redo a plant in a small town in Oregon, they're already doing this under the federal dollars are involved. This isn't new. I don't think it's overly burdensome for the good that it will do for our state and our country.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Wolby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just along those lines, along those federal standards, is the, because this applies to all manufactured goods, not just steel. I know the focus is on steel because we have great examples of the impact of foreign steel. But the 25% figure, the threshold there, does that mirror the federal standards as well?
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, I mentioned in my testimony that there are a few different types of federal standards depending on the project. This mirrors what is in most of the federal standards.
Follow up, Madam Chair, and I'm guessing, and I don't know this, but I suspect that the federal government did some sort of analysis to come up with that 25% number, just gauging what kind of impact this has to our economy and American jobs, and you know, so they're establishing a value on you know what the peripheral jobs that are created by using products that are from the U.S. essentially, and so they, I'm guessing that they established that 25% because they see that kind of value in using manufactured products from the United States. Maybe reading between the lines, but I was curious if there may be some information out there about that.
Chair Doherty, Representative Holvey, I don't have a study that specifically says that, but I know that especially as we went into the Recovery Act dollars and the standards that were put into that federal legislation, that there was a lot of work that went into looking at what the impacts were of jobs created by things like this. So most of those numbers were pretty specifically chosen.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions, the panelists? Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Actually, I'm going to bring up Paul Mather from ODOT to give us a little background, some information, and then we'll have two other panels after that are on deck.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I thought I'd go over you a little bit about the Federal Buy America Act that we deal with at ODOT and talk to you about how we administer that, as well as some of the concerns we have with some of the nuances of what it takes to administer that type of program and how some of the things in this bill don't quite match up with how we administer that. We've been dealing or working with a Federal Buy America Act for approximately the last 15 years. We deal with it as an agency in three different ways: Federal Transit Agency, Federal Rail Administration, and FHWA, and each administering these programs in the nuances of how you do that kind of in a project management, kind of a real life situations, and I'll get into some of those. So the vast majority of the projects that we administer here at ODOT are subject to Federal Buy America, and we've had to work through, again, the implementation of those, the practical realities of doing this program for approximately the last 15 years. And so our concern is we have a well-developed program that we've worked with the federal agencies to work through some of the operating guidelines of how you do a bill like or a program like this. And it's taken us 15 years, and in reality, we're still working through some of those nuances almost every day and still trying to understand how every day there's new situations that come up that we hadn't predicted. How do we deal with this nuance with the program? So it's a very complicated program to work with. And so our concern is now taking this bill and dovetailing it together with all the work that's been done already with the federal bill. And how do you, again, on a practical level, deal now with two different programs simultaneously on the same project? So let me talk about some of the specific things, maybe just as examples. One of those is emergency work in the federal world. If we're in the have a project landslide, say happens in the middle of the night, and our crew's out there trying to get that highway open, and we use federal funds, that's not subject to Federal Buy America. In this bill, we would be subject to Buy America, and again, we'd have to work through to try to find an expedited process to obviously meet the priority of getting that highway open as soon as possible. So emergency work is one area. Exceptions. So as you work through a project, say you're building a bridge, and we are dealing with steel fabrications, we're putting bolts and washers and so forth in that bridge, and we're getting the certifications for the steel. We get the bridge just about done. We realize we don't have the certifications for maybe the particular washer or bolt or so forth. If you take the bill literally, you'd have to go back, you know, unassemble the bridge, take those bolts off, put new ones on, and reassemble the bridge. There's public interest findings in the federal rules, as well as a small fraction of non-certified steel can be used in those projects to allow for those kind of exceptions, those kind of real world issues you deal with in project management, to allow you to keep the intent of the project going without suffering the project itself. So some of those nuances, again, we've been working on for the last 15 years to get those things built into the program. One of the things that we're dealing with more on an ongoing basis is some of the different aspects that we have in our projects. As our projects get more complicated, more technology into our projects, there's different pieces of equipment that get incorporated, whether it's a variable message sign, whether it's other technology gets incorporated, we get challenged with. But there's also other elements of a project that aren't permanently incorporated into the project. And so, again, using a bridge project as an example, the contractor goes out, builds a temporary structure to build a work bridge to allow a crane to go out and build the structure. That's usually steel. That's equipment or material owned by the contractor. They transport from one project to the next. Typically, they don't have certifications on that steel for that temporary structure. For the federal requirements, it has to be permanently incorporated into the project, not something that's a crane or a piece of steel for a temporary bridge. There's nuances, again, that we've worked out to what qualifies and what doesn't qualify for the My America program. So anyway, another piece that we've worked out on the federal side, and we come up with examples almost daily that we hadn't thought of before that we reinterpret through the federal rules to apply. So those are just some of the nuances as you try to now take a state program and incorporate that into a very complex project. And put those Buy America requirements into on the federal side into a program that hasn't been as developed like we have with the federal program for, again, the last 15 years.
Okay. Are there any questions, Mr. Mather? Representative Wendt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mather, you brought up a couple of concerns here that I'd like to see addressed. You mentioned the potential of a landslide occurring during the middle of the night, an emergency situation. If ODOT needs steel in the middle of the night, do you go out and go down to the local steel distributor in the middle of the night and purchase steel?
Madam Chair, Representative, typically it wouldn't be a steel like we think of maybe in bridge, but maybe it's a piece of guardrail that's needed, maybe some mm-hmm. steel guardrail posts. Typically, we may have those on hand in our maintenance shop. We may not have the certifications, you know, for those on hand, and we'd actually go out and have to, again, find those certifications or find guardrail that had certifications or develop a process internally where those materials that we keep on hand in our maintenance shops do have the certification available for those situations. So, again, it's just a nuance. I'm not saying it's something that's a fatal flaw, but it's something we'd have to work through and really understand.
Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. So it's conceivable that in anticipation of potential landslides or other emergencies, ODOT could have an adequate supply of domestic steel available to it.
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, that's possible, but again, we'd have to develop a process to ensure that we had those certifications on hand and be able to do that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one additional question. Thank you. You also mentioned the concerns about bolts and that sort of thing. And the potential that this would require dismantling of structures, and that certainly would not be in the public's interest. I'm wondering if we had a percentage of content of domestic steel or we address things such as structural steel, does this get us past those kinds of concerns?
Madam Chair, Representative Witt, yeah, that's the type of thing that we talk about in the federal program. I believe it's a 0.1% that is allowed to be an exception on a project, so that gets you by some of those things that I described.
Either one of those methods would work. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, I wonder, because we're all trying to look out for Oregon jobs, American jobs and stuff here, and I like to look out for my district. I wonder if we could, if we went to percentages like that and just say 80% has to be Schnitzer steel, since it's produced in my district, and we just take care of one of my clients, or customers, I guess, that I represent, so, when we're doing this. But I don't think we could be that specific with the bill, could we, Madam Chair?
Is that a question?
I'm sure they, ODOT uses Schnitzer steel in most of their projects.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I don't believe that we'd be able to do that under the federal rules and be able to qualify for federal funds.
It was a facetious question, sorry.
Okay, fine, thank you. Any other questions of Mr. Mather? Representative Thatcher.
Just a clarification, and thank you for coming and explaining more clearly some of the, I guess, complications. I do basically want to clarify that even if you know a piece of steel was manufactured here, if the paperwork doesn't exist, it doesn't count. Correct?
Right, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's often the situation we find ourselves in. We're you know, pretty sure that it, where it comes from, we know the truck it came off of, but we don't have the proper certifications or paperwork that would qualify for that piece of steel.
Representative Kinnaman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mathers, I just wanted to thank you. You make very specific suggestions, and that's helpful.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Good. Thanks.
Okay, next I have Scott Winkles, Jim Loader, and Mike Eliason.
Good morning, members of the committee. Madam Chair, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. And I will tell you that, speaking of the first panel that came up, we are more, I do a lot of environmental issues, and we are more and more sitting together as partners in front of committees. And so this is a little bit painful for me being on the other side. But we understand this is a very complicated issue, and there are a lot of sides to it. We have about 300 members who manufacture things. We have a lot of members who make things. And what Scott and I wanted to touch on here is, quickly, because I know you don't have a lot of time, is to talk about something that kind of brings us up to date here. And that is, in the 2010 special session, there was, as Mr. Molas referred to, there was a very large work group put together at the request of Senator Verger that was very broad, had public and private interests. And we hashed through what we thought was every possible permutation. And I passed out the report to you. It is submitted on the behalf of Mr. Winkles, League of Oregon Cities, and myself, kind of representing the private sector and public sector, but it represents the views of a lot of people who occur within those groups. There's going to be another panel that's going to deal with the details of the bill, so I'm just going to touch on some issues that came up that we thought were important. One is, there was a lot of concern about what represents best value for the taxpayer, and things generally that we saw driving up the price of construction or bids, we didn't see as falling in lines of what would be best value for the taxpayer. In other words, how many schools can you get built for a certain amount of money, per se? There was concern about complications with bid delays or contests with bids, simply because we're making it more complicated, and when you do that, there will be more things to be debated. There were some concerns, I think probably will come up, about some of the definitions, like what constitutes materials or material, and what pieces from what come from where. And so I just wanted to mention this and say this is a complex issue. I think you've heard from ODOT that perhaps there are other things need to be addressed, but we would ask the committee to be very careful on this and be very cognizant about when you drive up costs on a project, material costs, labor costs, the amount of money you can spend on labor building it go down. And sometimes the cost you spend on material, or the construction, the materials, may be generated in Oregon, may be generated other places. But all the amount that you get reduced on
labor building it, that will all come in Oregon, come from Oregon. That reduction will come from Oregon. And so we ask you to bear these things in mind, and we would hope that there'll be further work on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. As my friend and colleague, Mr. Ledger, stated, John and I were chair of the public sector, private sector work group to take a look at this, and we did spend several hours trying to come up with some ways to make something work. And you know, we involved legal counsel, we involved public works directors, we involved contracting experts, and we couldn't find a cost-effective way of moving something like this forward. The challenge, I would like to respond to some comments made by the previous panel, and I think when we say that this is exactly like the federal standard, I think there's actually a couple of notable distinctions, if not in language and in practice. And one of those is that in the federal standards and the DOT standards, for instance, there is a federal agency that can help guide you through this process. There's a certification process. I haven't seen a state agency volunteer to certify that the products are in compliance. I haven't seen one of the state agencies volunteer to say that we can help you navigate this process. And they, like a local government, ensure, give them the certainty that their decisions won't be challenged through judicial review. Secondly, there's also the federal Buy America and the federal Buy American, and the there's still one on the books from 1933. There are a couple of there's a few more off-ramps that this bill doesn't contain. So, for instance, under the federal system now, the president has the authority to grant waivers dealing with reciprocal trade agreements. There's currently a nationwide waiver on certain manufactured goods due to compliance. In the ARRA, for instance, in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, there was a protest from Canada where the ARRA, actually the sister organization to the National League of Cities, protested and was discussing boycotts of American products over the Buy American provisions in ARRA. And so there are waivers for certain Canadian products going forward under the ARRA provisions. And so I think those distinctions, I think, are significant in that there is not the same certification process that you would have if you would get from the Federal Department of Transportation and complying with the federal standards, and these off-ramps dealing with these reciprocal trade agreements, which make the federal standard somewhat more flexible. And there was also a comment as to what we could do to improve Oregon jobs. Well, actually, we have some ideas. The first thing is we could fully recapitalize the Special Public Works Loan Fund, and that will put people to the Special Public Works Fund. We've also looked at, the League has some proposals in front of the Ways and Means Committee on Brownsfield redevelopment, where we have industrial sites that, but for the brownfield, could be have people working on them. The infrastructure is already there. We can do those things, and those things would put people to work. With that, I think I'll close. But I think to say that this is exact, I don't think that is 100% accurate to say that it is exactly like the federal standards.
Mr. Weiser.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Michael Eisen with the Association of Oregon Counties. Some of the prior speakers have made some good points, so I'll be fairly brief. But our association was also part of the work group in the interim of 2010. When these concepts first started coming forward, first I saw them were 2009, but could have been earlier than that. We had numerous conversations internally within our association, commissioners who were very instinctively or intuitively supportive, wanted to figure out a way that we could, as an association, support a concept such as this. And we also, as I said, participate in the work group. We cannot actually support this concept for a variety of reasons. We've already heard a similar bill once this session in a different committee, House Bill 2402, and this is a slightly different version. But I'll quickly touch on, four of the many reasons we have some concerns with this. Cost has already been mentioned on several occasions. Shrinking public budgets, whether it's schools, cities, special districts, counties, adding 25%, up to 25% in material costs, is simply will result in smaller projects, less projects, if there's a bond for a set amount of money for a project that passes, and now you're adding up to 25% more in costs. It simply results in less projects, smaller projects, et cetera. Again, it's been mentioned several times, the certification issues. If ODOT, which is one of the largest state agencies we have, has spent 15 years trying to navigate and figure out a process that works for them, asking extremely small local governments to try to navigate that on every public works project they do over $50,000 presents some significant logistical challenges. The enforcement aspect, the remedies, all of those situations have been touched on, but are not addressed in the bill, and we have real concerns on how that would work if someone were to challenge something that's a component of a manufactured good, for instance, how a small local government would go about trying to figure out how that works is simply a challenge that I think is much different than the federal Buy America. So with that, I'll close. Be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions? Representative Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to Mr. Winkles, and many bills are imperfect and can be improved, and I'm not suggesting that this one isn't without need for improvements perhaps somewhere. So you mentioned in your testimony that there are off-ramps in federal legislation that don't exist in this bill, and I'm wondering if we granted the President of the United States the opportunity to provide waivers for Oregon Steel reciprocal trade agreements or Canadian Steel, would you then be able to support this bill?
Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, I don't know that there's a lobbyist in the building who's going to say he can support something without reading the words, but I can say that I think we, I don't know if that's the President of the United States wants to.
Well, if that's an off-ramp that you mentioned, conceptually, could you support the bill then?
No, I think we still have some issues with the cost issue, and the one of the interesting things about the way this is phrased is that the cost is on, if it raises the cost of construction by 25%, not the cost of materials, and so you're well into your, I think in a way you could even argue that this bill actually prioritizes expenditures on materials over the actual labor cost. That's one issue. With this, I think we still have the cost issues, and I think there's also the assistance in compliance that we get from DOT.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I was just thinking how this might interface with the Buy Oregon First bill, and it seems to me like you could have a Washington company bid on a project for $100,000, and then an Oregon company can bid $110,000. They would be given that preference. But under this, perhaps a company from Pittsburgh might be able to bid a job for $138,500 and be 25% more. But they would, if they're certifying the 100% Buy America steel manufactured goods, then it would go to them under this scenario, perhaps.
Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher, I don't have the current Buy Oregon bill in front of me, but my recollection is that bill applied to 279B, and this we're talking about 279C, the construction code. Mr. Eliason may be more knowledgeable on that aspect.
Chair Doherty, Representative Thatcher. Scott's correct, and also I should note that the Buy Oregon bill that passed that refers to goods and services is actually a permissive preference, not a mandated preference. So indeed that could be the case, that you could apply that, but it wouldn't be mandatory, so it wouldn't happen in all situations.
Okay. Other questions of the panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, next we have Lori, and excuse me, Mr. Ledger, for mispronouncing your name. Lori Stattenspiel, Mark Landauer, and John Rakowitz.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Public Ports Association in opposition to House Bill 3473. Despite the good intentions of the proponents of this bill, we believe that it will result in a net increase of cost to the public for public works projects and potentially lead to construction delays and bid challenges. Furthermore, the bill leaves a number of key words undefined and provides no guidance, as some of the previous speakers mentioned, on the remedies that would be needed to be followed in the event that, for whatever reason, the intent or actual true words of the bill were violated. As the supporters of this bill mentioned, Buy America has been in place for a good number of years, and that under their presumption, they believe that most public contracting agencies are familiar and experienced with the Buy America provisions. I represent approximately 950 special districts across the state of Oregon. I also represent 23 public ports from the state of Oregon. I can assure you that most of those districts have never received federal monies and are not familiar with the federal Buy America provisions. The previous speakers also mentioned some certification issues. I won't delve into those. I will say, though, that this bill could very well open up bid protests by potential bidders who did not receive or win a project based on the fact that they may challenge the winning bidder's ability or in fact, their implementation of the bill. Of course, that would lead to delays in construction and, of course, increased costs as well. I want to mention two things. One that was mentioned by Mr. Mather on line 8 and 9 of the bill. The bill requires that steel, iron, and manufactured goods need to be used in, and I underline and stress the word in, a public improvement or public works project. I believe that that word needs to be defined. I think that the intent of the bill is that the steel, iron, or manufactured goods would be a permanent part of the public improvement project. However, one could certainly interpret that word in as also being the tools or machines that are being used in order to construct the public facility. So that's just a nuance. The other word that I believe really needs to be drilled down and defined is, what is manufactured goods and what does it mean by made in America? So, for example, a heating and ventilation system. If a belt, in order to turn a motor in an HVAC system, is actually made in Indonesia and is a part of that larger system, does that automatically disqualify that entire system as being manufactured in the United States? There's no guidance on that. Okay, if a screw, as Mr. Mather mentioned, is used and made in China to drill in the drywall of a larger project, does the screws need to be removed, or does the entire project need to be torn down and reworked? Okay, these are questions that this bill does not address, and frankly, my districts have to face that who have no experience with that. I think the intent is well intended, but the execution of this bill is short, and with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, Lori Satinsville for the Oregon School Board is here with concerns on 3473. I actually sent this bill out to all of my facility directors at districts large enough to have a facility director to get some input. And I was hopeful to hear from David Douglas because they've, passed a bond and working on construction. School districts have a huge backlog of deferred maintenance, and I've got concerns about how this bill impacts those districts' abilities to get that backlog completed timely. And the biggest thing is being accountable to the local community for use of the dollars.
We've got some bills sitting down in Ways and Means for some bonding authority, and districts will need to go out for a match in order to start working on that backlog. So I'm not going to get down in the weeds. I worry about enforcement, again, what we've heard, and increased costs. Some of our smaller districts, of course, would have to hire someone to help manage a project. And again, the risk involved with who they hire to do that concerns us all. So I'd be happy to try to answer questions. I did not hear back from David Douglas or other facility people, just a sheer amount of time that it takes to get all these answers and compiled. But I would be happy to follow up if anybody in particular would like me to report back.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. I want to start with the intent of the bill. I hope everybody understands, is something we're in complete agreement with. We start our board meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. If we had our druthers, we'd source everything in this country. So that it's a lovely concept. The practicalities of it is what just leave us no choice but to oppose this bill. And I'm going to try to not duplicate what others said. I think a lot of issues have been raised. I'm just going to talk about it strictly from an industry perspective and what our experience has been. And I'll start with the comparison to the ODOT program. I was a part of House Bill 2800 and the public contracting requirements that are contained in there. And we negotiated something out that allowed the absolute duplication of the current federal program that ODOT has described here this morning that has been in the works now for 15 years. That's why we could support that. In comparison to this bill, and I really want to just read from the bill, we need to think about how broad and deep of implication this bill really has. A public body may not enter into a contract with a contract price of more than $50,000. That's a pretty small contract. All public bodies to construct, reconstruct, renovate, alter, maintain, or repair a public improvement or public works unless the iron, steel, and manufactured goods are produced within the United States. That touches virtually every public project in this state, as opposed to, say, an ODOT, which is a particular kind of construction, number one, with considerably more limited number of products. So for 15 years, they've been sorting out how do you implement that for one kind of construction, how you certify it, etc. So this is what we saw. In 2010, I started getting calls from contractors looking for help based upon projects that they had done that had federal ERISA money involved. One in particular, I remember, I got a call from a contractor who had done a small guardrail job in LeGrand. She had completed the job a few months before. She couldn't get to final payment. Why? She could not certify, or the agency could not certify, the bolts in the project. In a company of that size, the final payment is the profit margin. It is what keeps the payroll going, because she has to pay all of her bills. So it at the front end, that's the back end. At the front end, what we saw was bid protest. It's a highly competitive market. People, frankly, are public partners and public owners drive a hard bargain. They're driving the cost down. So everybody's competing to try to get what is a lot smaller work. When that happens, if you have an entire new certification program in place like this bill calls for, that just creates that many more opportunities for bid protest. So at the front end and the back end, that's what we see. Ultimately, the big thing, I guess, message that I want to deliver today to the committee to consider is this. We don't know how much each individual project cost on the material supply will increase. What we know is it's allowed to increase up to 25%. So take any, you know, renovation, a rehab, a new construction, whatever. One project may have a 2% increase in materials cost. The next project may have a 10 or 12. The next one may have a 24%. All of those costs with limited fixed budgets mean less construction, which means less work for the contractors in our industry and the people who deliver the projects, all the trades, men and women, who actually do the work and build these projects. So when you look at the big picture or you look at the practicalities, it's a great idea, but I was a part of that work group in 2010, and we spent four or five meetings, 4 or 5 hours each time, everybody around the table, trying to find a way to come up with something that would work, and we couldn't do it. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions, panelists? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rakowitz, I very much appreciate your very thoughtful consideration of this bill. And my question is, what would make a good bill like House Bill 3473 an even better bill? What few items?
Chair Doherty, Representative Witt, it's about, I think, phase-in. It is about the breadth and depth of the bill. I'll say that. Phase-in meaning on the practical implications. How do you put a certification system together? So the only thing I can think of, and I'm not authorized to support any of this, but the only thing I can think of is narrow. Narrow the number of products involved, narrow the number of agencies that it would apply to, increase the size. I mean, type of projects. That's why I read from the bill, just to see how broad and deep it is that this is an all-encompassing bill. So I certainly think there are ways to try to go to work on this, but it's going to take a long time, work, and a narrowing to figure out how you go about something like this that doesn't have the kind of impacts I just described. So I think there's always, I'm prepared, and I'm sure everybody is prepared to sit down and talk. I have not been engaged in this bill's construction whatsoever, but I know the issue pretty well. So I don't know if that helps or not, but that's the best I can come up with at the moment.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much. Okay, that's all we have signed up for House Bill 3473. Anybody else want to speak on it? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3473. And we're going to stand down just for a moment. We wanted to make sure those were clear.
2256 is ready.
Okay.
It's ready.
Got it. Okay. And then we carry over to the next page. Okay. Okay. Close the public hearing, if I haven't already, on 3473, and I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2692. Jan, if you could summarize it, please.
No, Madam Chair. This measure requires the school district to determine the competency of teachers when considering which teachers are going to be retained when the school district is laying off staff. Declares an emergency effective July 1. The dash 2 amendments were adopted by the committee on Monday. It replaced the measure and want a refresher on the, I will provide. It requires the school districts, when they're going to reduce the teacher positions, to make every reasonable effort to combine teaching positions, so long as those teachers that are retained are competent for the combined position. It allows the school district to transfer teachers to different subjects or grade levels when making reductions, as long as they are competent. and declares an emergency effective July 1st. There is no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued, and there is no subsequent referral.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gordon.
It's already been amended, and so you're looking to move to the floor as amended, correct?
Correct.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2692 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 2692 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on Monday, you know, I made a couple comments about this bill, and I appreciate having the ability to kind of go to the sponsors and find out just exactly what the intent was and the effect of the Dash 2. My clear understanding is that there was a work group that kind of got together in discussion on the Dash 2, and people are very comfortable with moving forward. So any concern I had about the ability for a district to somehow bypass senior teachers to get to lower paid early entry-level teachers, those have been removed, and I'll be supporting the bill. But thank you for the opportunity to just kind of explain that. I had some grave concerns on Monday just based on limited info. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes, and we'll ask Representative Greenlick to carry the bill on the floor. With this, I close with a work session on House Bill 2692. House Bill 2672 will be carried over. House Bill 2214 will not be heard. We'll not be have a hearing on that one. House Bill 2296. Open a work session on House Bill 2296.
Chair and committee members, this is the measure that allows a conversion or a corporate creation of a corporation into a benefit company. There is the Dash 3 before you that modifies the approval process when they are converting, and there is the Dash 5 that establishes the intent of the Legislative Assembly through some whereas clauses, and that was to address the any tax preference or any contracting preferences that they would not be granted to the benefit companies. And those amendments were not adopted. And there's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact.
Okay. Representative Barton.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2296.
Okay. Representative Barton moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2296. Is there a discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Can she reiterate again what the Dash 3 was exactly?
I will. I
forgot already.
I understand.
The Dash 3 deals with the process of a vote to convert into a benefit company that requires a majority vote for each class of voting members.
And that was with the shareholders?
Yes.
Shareholders of the corporation.
Madam Chair. Okay. It shows the Dash 5 as well.
We have no, that's next.
Okay.
Okay, we need to adopt one before we adopt the other. Okay, any other discussion on the Dash 3s? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments in House Bill 2296.
Okay, Representative Barton moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2296. Is there any discussion? Do you need a chance to go over what those are again? The Dash 5s?
It wouldn't hurt.
Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, Dash 5 addressed the concern that the committee had about making sure that benefit companies wouldn't have any special preference for taxes or for contracts. So these sponsors of the measure came back with the Dash 5. It has two whereas clauses that the whereas the Legislative Assembly intends with the Act to provide legal means to create these benefit companies. And whereas the Legislative Assembly understands and intends that the provisions of the Act do not give a benefit company a preference for public contracts, provide a benefit company with any tax advantage, or otherwise permit the state, an agency of the state, or local government to grant a preference or an advantage to a benefit company.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Discussion.
Just wanted to thank the sponsors of the bill for their cooperation on this amendment.
Because that was your concern that we had last
time. It was. Yeah. And I just tried to understand whether we were creating a new class that had special privilege or not.
Okay, so
and I think this clarifies that.
Okay.
That it does not.
Okay, any other discussion?
Actually, Madam Chair, that's were my questions when we heard this bill, and this amendment actually addresses the concerns I had as well. So,
okay.
I support the dash fives.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there objection? Okay, seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2296 to the floor. Do pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 2296 to the floor with a do pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Fagan.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Weiser.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
No.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. And we'll ask Representative Reed to carry this on the floor. Okay, with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2469.
2296.
Close the work session on 2296. And I open the work session on House Bill 2524. Jan, if you could summarize. And
Madam Chair, can you mention the bill limits the exemption from construction contractor licensing requirements for financial institutions, real estate personnel, and suppliers of workers. You have before you three amendments. Representative Foley, would you like me to go through those amendments, or did you want to address?
I can do it if you would prefer. It's fine with me. Thank you. Committee members, I as you recall, this bill was dealing with the exemptions to being licensed as a construction contractor through the Construction Contractors Board, and some of the issues that were brought up were thinking back about this was we have a financial industry and a real estate industry which can all perform currently work that requires a construction contractor's license for everybody else, and they're exempt from that those laws. And there's been some issues that I'm aware of, and with other contractor groups as well, where real estate industry is performing this work without the same sort of bonding, insurance, and education requirements that are required of construction contractors, and as such, they're competing with the construction contractors on that work or taking that work from them. And I appreciate the concerns of the real estate industry. I drafted the dash fours, which did address the concerns of the bankers from last. Conversation with them, and we did raise the limit of work that they could do, and it's considered casual, I guess, from $500 to $1,000, and that was something that they thought was reasonable. I think that's also reasonable in today's world. The real estate industry came back with the Dash 5 amendment, which allows the licensee, they took out, and let me go back, the original bill still allows the banking industry and the real estate industry to arrange for the work to be done, which actually requires, in every other, if you're not exempt, requires a construction contractor's license. And so the original bill kind of, you know, compromised on that to say, well, you can still arrange to have the work done, but if you're going to perform the work, it needs to be done by a licensed contractor. That's the concept behind this, pretty clean and straightforward. And of course, then that was brought up to me about all the property management and those sorts of issues, and the real estate industry came back with the Dash 5 amendments, which took out the reference to arranging have the work done, but just allows them to perform work for the management of rental real estate. However, that language seems to open up, it addresses the licensees, all licensees. Real estate licensees, brokers, real estate management, property management license, to be able to perform the work, actually, if they engage in the management of rental real estate. And so that particular amendment, after review and talking to legislative council, really doesn't change their current exemption very much at all. And so I'm not supportive of that amendment. I came back with a Dash 7 to specifically address the property management being able to do work and perform work to the extent that the work does not require a building permit. So that was the compromise threshold I came up with, was that if the work requires a building permit, then it needs to be performed by a construction contractor licensee. And then the real estate, I think you saw I sent that email out to the committee last night, and Paul Rainey did respond that they're not supportive of that Dash 7 amendment. I did get a response from Mr. Bill Cross, who believed that BOMA would be supportive of the Dash 7s, that it addresses their particular issues. And so there you have it. I'm supportive of either the Dash 4 or the Dash 7 amendments. And that's the amendments before you.
Okay. We're not going to be moving this today because we also need a fiscal on it. But are there any questions of Mr. Holvey? Representative Matthews?
Just in a...
Can we do that?
I know there's a de minimis standard and everything, but if I were managing a real estate property and fence repair was needed, I had to take two panels or three panels, does that require a building permit? Or if I were going to put a fence on a property, does that require a building permit?
I probably have to defer to Craig Smith to answer that question. I think
we can take that off.
Some panels, probably not repairing, probably not. But I'm guessing if you're putting in a brand new fence, it may in fact require a permit.
Okay, I'll check that. Thank you.
So. Okay,
I see a nod out there, but
yeah. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Thatcher, did you have a question? Yes.
I guess I do, yeah. And bottom line, this amendment does this, this piece does this, this piece does this. Bottom line, if we adopted all three amendments, what would be the concept, the basic concept of the bill? I mean, how much does it change?
If we adopted all three amendments, I am not certain that the only change in the bill would be that the financial industry would no longer be able to perform work that required a construction contractor's license, but they could arrange for the work, and it probably would not change anything. The Dash 5 is not consistent with the Dash 7, so it would be hard to adopt all three amendments. And the Dash 5 amendment would essentially allow the real estate industry, and from my conversations, to basically continue to contract and perform work without the same bonding insurance and liability coverages that construction and educational requirements that the construction contractors have.
Okay, thank you. I guess I'm just trying to figure out what we're trying to fix. Are there a bunch of bank tellers after hours going out and pounding nails and some property? I'm just trying to picture this.
Yeah, and I don't know if Mr. Smith would comment, but the fact is that we do have real estate brokers and real estate people that are doing construction work, remodeling on houses and flipping them, and I mean, that's a big concern, and in fact, the real estate industry is performing construction contractor work without the proper license, and it's not just a de minimis, you know, fix a hole in the wall and things like that. And they're exempt from having those licenses, so they're, you know, legal to go out and build a brand new house if they wanted to.
Okay, we do have people out here from the other industry. We've got about 5 minutes left on this topic. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to speak on the amendments? Mr. Rainey. Thank you. And if you could just kind of watch the time. Thank you. If not, I'll watch it for you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Paul Rainey with the Oregon Association of Realtors. And what I really want to address here is specifically regarding the current exemption. The problem referenced by Representative Polvey is addressed in the Dash 5 amendments. You have a broker, a principal broker, and a property management licensee under the real estate license law. What he's referring to is real estate licenses who are selling real estate that are acting out of the scope of their practice. What the Dash 5s is limit that property owners who are real estate management companies managing property would still have the ability to use this exception. What the Dash 5 does is clarifies that a real estate broker or a principal broker cannot use this for selling real estate. So that is, when you go back to the initial intent in the legislation, that gets at what he was pursuing. I think that addresses that problem. I think in regards to the Dash 7, the language would limit it to a more specific property manager. There's two different licensees within statutes, and I don't believe that was the intent. But when you get to the actual permit process, I think Gwen here from Multifamily Northwest could speak to some more technical concerns with that.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Gwen Baldwin representing Multifamily Northwest. You know, certainly we're in the business of property management. We're in the business of making sure the properties are safe and sound, and that the work that is done by maintenance crews from property management organizations are based on educated, trained, talented, dedicated workers. We support the Dash 5 amendments because we believe that it does highlight and address the issue, which is the concern, which is folks who aren't in the business of property management, doing, whether it's ADUs or flipping homes or suddenly doing things that are outside what they're really trained and scoped to do. And that we think by adopting the Dash 5s, you're talking specifically about that exemption being restricted to folks who engage in management of real estate. You know, to the definition, as was said earlier, there are two different definitions. Certainly 696.010.18 specifically talks about the real estate property manager means a real estate licensee who engages in the management of real estate and is a licensed real estate property manager, a licensed real estate broker, or a licensed real estate broker who is associated and supervised with a property real estate broker. But the specifics to this are they're in the business of property management, and that's what we want to make sure can be continued for maintenance work. To the permit issue, there are, I would agree that depends on the circumstances, but a fence would require a permit. There are also there are mixed codes related to permits. There are certainly some permits that or maintenance work that's done that actually does not require a permit. But there are things like if you were swapping out a water heater, you would have to pull a permit, and that's something that, again, our property maintenance folks are eminently trained to do. In fact, March 14th, we just had our maintenance fair, which had hundreds of maintenance staff, vendors from all over, education and training sessions specifically on things from mold to water and electrical work to spas and pools, federal and state and local laws. I mean, we're in the business of training and educating our folks to be good providers of quality rental housing.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions?
Just
one, two, three.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we keep saying licensed property management, just so that I understand. Is there any requirement to display any competency in construction prior to becoming a licensed property management, or is that just a broad term and we're not talking about hot water heaters, we're actually talking about wall removal and door removal and electrical? I mean, is there...
The property management licensee is under the REA, but there is, if you are doing things that are that kind of life, health, safety, you absolutely have to have a permit. You have to be a licensed contractor who's licensed, bonded, and insured. We're talking about maintenance.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Holby, did you have a question?
Well to clarify your definition of a person that manages real estate, as opposed to somebody who's licensed as a property manager, there is a difference, mm-hmm. and I think you've pointed it out. So essentially, in the dash fives, a property management licensee could perform work. And also, the broker could also perform work under the dash five. Is that not correct? Or either one can answer.
If the broker is actively engaged in the management of real estate, but if they're actively engaged in the management of real estate, they should be allowed to either perform or arrange for the work to be done, which is what the original language does.
So a quick follow-up. We've got about 3 minutes left for this entire issue.
Okay, so the idea that they engage in property management, I would assume that is a pretty broad interpretation of what is managing property, and just opens it up to brokers being able to perform work, essentially, and not just the licensed property managers. I was okay having licensed property managers perform work, which is, I think, a concession as well, but to open it up to all brokers, because I think almost all brokers could very easily be engaged in the management of real estate.
Well, Representative Doherty, Representative Holby, I think the thing to remember here on this is we're not talking for the sale. We're talking people who are licensed to manage real estate. That's what the existing exemption does. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what the problem is within the property management community that would be pushing this. What we are working to address was the issue brought up that real estate licensees were flipping and selling and not using a construction contractor. That's already illegal. We want to clarify that that's illegal, but we don't want to punish property managers who are acting within the scope of their license.
Okay, Representative Kinnemer, did you have a question?
I guess I want to clarify. If I understood, both of you are supportive of the dash five, but not the sevens.
Yes.
Thank you. Any other quick questions? Okay, thank you. This is going to be carried over anyway because we need a fiscal on this. In fact, the remaining bills all have fiscals that have not come in, so they will all be carried over, and I'll be more specific about that at the end. So with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2524. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2669. There are some amendments that need to be discussed from Boley and OUS. Are you guys going to do that? 2669. Okay, thank you. In about five minutes.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for Oregon University System. I just wanted to speak briefly in reference to House Bill 2669. OUS is supportive of this bill. We appreciate the intentions of it. What we have worked out with Boley is an amendment that is primarily a definitional amendment, which is defining the term of intern. Right now, the legislation pertains to individuals who do work for educational purposes, which is very expansive. And that creates with it some additional risk issues for us. And what we had asked is just to be able to apply a definition very in line with what the federal government uses for intern. Currently, there is no definition in Oregon statute of interns. So we've worked with Boley, identified an appropriate definition, and we're very happy and supportive of the bill once that amendment is adopted on the Senate side. But we're comfortable with it moving forward. Okay. Happy to answer any questions.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Elizabeth Kushwa for Boley, and I'll defer to Representative Fardrak.
Thank you. just rushing in.
And you're talking about the amendments.
I am talking about the amendments. Thank you very much.
And Representative Frick, we're not working this bill because we still have a fiscal that we need to deal with.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
I'm Representative Lou Frederick, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. We wanted to make sure that there were some significant issues concerning the internship and what the definition of internship was and was not. And this is what we've worked with the folks at OUS on, and I think we've got some things pretty well put together on that. It continues to be a very basic situation for me. I want to make sure that folks are not discriminated against, and I don't want to have anybody decide to pick what you should be able to discriminate about. Because we've got students who are out there doing a lot of work, and they need to have that kind of protection. It's a very simple question.
Questions about the amendments? Representative Manchin.
Just a real quick question. I understand there's a fiscal out there that may be on this bill from OUS. Is that a fiscal that was prior to the amendment or with the amendment?
Chair Doherty, Representative Matthews, that was prior to the amendment, and we believe that is more indeterminate based on the different questions that arise prior to defining the term. Once you narrowly define the term, you're going to mitigate most of that cost, and we think it's something we could easily absorb. So it's really just a matter of the amendment that kind of solves all of our issues. Okay. We're very happy with it.
Okay, thank you for your work, and Ms. Kushwa, thank you for yours, and thank you, Representative.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes.
Madam Chair, we're going to see the amendment here then? Because now I'm hearing that we're going to send it to the Senate and let them put it
down. They're actually working the amendment on the Senate side?
Madam Chair. Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, you have before you their proposed amendment. It may not look familiar. It's not in LC format. You have a hard copy, and it's also on OLIS.
There's a question mark.
I understand that they're talking about actually adopting the amendment over on the Senate side.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, and the reason for this is that right now LFO has 600 fiscals on amendments for 4.5 people, and we realized that this couldn't happen on this side in the appropriate amount of time, and now that we have the agreement with OUS, we feel that we have a good bill that should continue to move forward, and we have made an absolute commitment to OUS to amend the bill with this language on the other side.
Representative Barton, did you have a question?
No, it's okay.
Okay. Representative Kinnaman?
Yeah, I just wondered, does this... I haven't had a moment to look at this, and I don't think this...
This is why we're carrying it over.
This addresses some of the concerns that were brought up by Associated Oregon Industries.
Representative Doherty, Representative Kennemer, yes. Mr. Wilson was brought up with me his concern over 659A-030-1B, mentioning compensation. The OUS plain language amendment clearly settles that by saying that interns are not entitled to wages. All of the other individuals here are the pieces of 659A that we have referenced do not have to do with wage and hour or leave laws. This is merely for internships, and we reviewed those sections that do not apply to employment, which is why we chose the sections of the statute that we did. I just want to make this clear again. This merely extends the protections, the anti-discrimination protections that all employees currently have to interns, just in discrimination.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for bringing the clarifications and for working together to resolve the issue. Okay, with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2669. And actually, the rest of the bills, we're still working on fiscals on these, so we'll be carrying over House Bill 2672, which is domestic workers, House Bill 2524, the CCB exemptions, House Bill 2669, interns, House Bill 2908, Interagency Compliance Network, House Bill 3076, Post-Employment Disputes, House Bill 3342, Union Organizing, and then the three that we heard today, just to make sure that they get on a schedule because of our timelines, carrying over House Bill 2410, House Bill 3180, and House Bill 3473. I back up. 2410 has actually been resolved, so we will not be carrying that one over. Thank you, Representative Barton. And that was Cranes. Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your patience, and we will see you Friday. With that, I close the House Business Labor Committee.